This is episode 29 of IDRA Class Notes.
Around each one of these goals, mm-hmm. asking, do we have the right policies in place mm-hmm. to ensure that this notion of equitability can come to life mm-hmm. with regards to access, inclusion, treatment, opportunity to learn, the resources to make that happen, and we're all stakeholders share accountability. So do we have the right policy decisions? Do we have the right funding initiatives mm-hmm. to allow these things to come to life in something more than just lip service? Mm-hmm. It becomes hugely important.
Welcome to the IDRA Class Notes podcast by the Intercultural Development Research Association. I'm Christy Goodman. In this podcast series, we explore issues facing education today and strategies for teachers and administrators to better serve every student. I want to share with you today the news that this podcast has received another award. This one is a statewide award in Texas for communications. And while it's nice to be recognized for the content of the show, this is really a testament to you, our listeners. You've been coming back, listening to past episodes, and telling other people. Our listenership has grown dramatically, and it's because of you. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your support and also encourage you to share with us your thoughts, questions, suggestions for future topics. There'll be details at the end of this podcast on how to contact us, but it's as simple as sending an email with whatever you want to say. We'd really like to hear from you. We've also set up an email alert to let you know when a new episode of Class Notes is available. If you're not subscribing to this podcast through iTunes or some other directory, our email alerts will help you stay up to date. You can just go to our website and sign up. Of course, it's free. And our topic today is Six Goals of Educational Equity with Dr. Bradley Scott, a voice that you know well. Bradley directs the IDRA South Central Collaborative for Equity. That's the Equity Assistance Center that's funded by the U.S. Department of Education to serve schools in Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. Bradley has a master's degree in early childhood and elementary education from the University of Texas at San Antonio and a doctor of philosophy with a concentration in educational administration from the University of Texas at Austin. And he's a national leader in the area of equitable schooling and is the developer of the Six Goals of Educational Equity that are being used across the country to help school leaders. So welcome, Bradley.
Well, Christy, welcome, or I should say thank you. It's very strange to be on this side of the microphone, but it sure is a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, thanks. And why don't we start with you giving us a little background about why you came up with these goals and how that came to be.
Well, actually, these goals find their origin as far back as the early 90s as we were looking at how the whole school reform process. But they didn't begin to take shape and form until around the mid-90s when we began talking about the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And most of our listeners will remember that we were talking about it under the rubric of Improving America Schools or the Improving mm-hmm. America Schools Act. And it became real clear to me at that time, Christy, that one of the things that we really had to do was to confront some of the persistent issues that caused these persistent realities, like the underperformance of minorities in comparison to their non-minority counterparts. The way that those kids whose first language is other than English and how they were performing in comparison to English-speaking children or children for whom English is their first language. And as you looked at these disaggregated populations, mm-hmm. you saw these persistent differences in achievement, in student outcomes, the kinds of courses they were taking, the kinds of opportunities that they were getting or not getting, and you could see the demarcation across these identifiable populations. And I became real concerned about that, and it became clear to me at that point in time that if America's schools were ever really to improve, mm-hmm. and now under No Child Left Behind, if we really want to make sure that we leave no child behind, we do have to ask some tough questions, mm-hmm. and we face some tough challenges, and that we ought to have as ends and outcomes of the proper ends of education, mm-hmm. equitable treatment for all students irrespective of race, gender, and national origin that will lead them to high outcomes, help them to become productive citizens, help them to be positioned so that they can either go on to college or move successfully into the world of work, and also become competent, responsible, productive citizens in whatever community they choose to live in. Mm-hmm. So these are huge challenges. Mm-hmm. And so I began to shape and form the goals of educational equity back then. And in fact, I began to do a lot of writing in the IDRA newsletter mm-hmm. around these goals of educational equity. And of course, our readers can go online mm-hmm. and look at those articles, because each of these are talked about in some depth.
Right.
And originally, we started out, or I started out with five goals,
five, yes.
But then it became quite clear to me that in order for this to work, all stakeholders had to see themselves as individually and jointly accountable mm-hmm. for making schools work, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. making schools serve our learners. And so I have become committed to that, and people around the nation do look to me in terms of not only talking about these in principle, mm-hmm. but also helping them to think about and to shape the reality mm-hmm. so that these come to life in fact.
Okay. Well, I would love for you to tell us a little bit about that. Let's go through the six, now six, because I know that one you mentioned became number six.
Sure.
But let's start at number one, and let's describe each one.
Well, let me give it over. Say the six are these.
Uh-huh.
The first is what I call comparable high achievement and other student outcomes. Mm-hmm. The second is what I refer to as equitable access and inclusion. The third is equitable treatment. Mm-hmm. The fourth goal deals with an equitable opportunity to learn. The fifth goal is an equitable distribution of resources. And then the last is this issue of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So we can back up and talk
okay.
about each one
Good.
Of those.
That's helpful.
I find it useful when we're talking about student outcomes not to just stop at the issue of achievement.
Mm-hmm.
It is very important under No Child Left Behind that kids are reaching high standards
mm-hmm.
In their learning, that kids are doing well in terms of their performance. But my position is, and always has been, that schooling is more than just what you do on the results of a test.
Mm-hmm.
School has to help our learners to look at issues such as positive, powerful decision making. Schools have to look at how learners become good problem solvers. They should look at what students do in terms of competent decision making. And so those are all outcomes mm-hmm. or products of good education mm-hmm. to help our students to be good thinkers, to be competent performers and actors around the business they are engaged in.
Mm-hmm.
And that we ought to be able to see that across all kinds of populations.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is true in terms of other important issues. Competent decision-making on parts of teachers mm-hmm. supports mm-hmm. high student outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Engagement of parents mm-hmm. and their carrying out their roles
mm-hmm.
In the success of their children, their sons and daughters in schools, are a part of all of these issues of high outcomes for students.
Mm-hmm.
And so I challenge school leadership. I challenge community leadership. I challenge parents and students themselves when they are of an age mm-hmm. developmentally to become engaged at that level to really think about what are the outcomes, what are the goals that are to be achieved, and how do I or others help to make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
The second goal is that goal of equitable access and inclusion. Now, as a technical assistance provider and director of an equity assistance center, we have always been concerned about this issue of access, particularly as it's shaped by law,
mm-hmm.
such as Title VI, the Civil Rights Act of Title VI, which prohibits discrimination,
mm-hmm.
and discrimination is a denial
right.
of access based upon race, color, and national origin, or Title IX, that prohibits discrimination, a denial of access based upon gender,
yeah.
or Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 that prohibits discrimination based upon one's handicapping condition.
Mm-hmm.
Those are violations of the law. They're not allowed. So our challenge has always been how do schools make sure that they're providing the greatest access to all learners, not only to the building,
mm-hmm.
but also to the things that are in the building,
mm-hmm.
the programs,
mm-hmm.
the curricular offerings, the extracurricular offerings, the co-curricular supports
mm-hmm.
that are important for school success. And to make sure that all students are included in that. And I constantly challenge school folk to ask themselves, first of all, what are the data showing? When we disaggregate this issue of equitable access and inclusion across our populations, Do you see comparability among whites and blacks and browns and English dominant or Spanish dominant or boys and girls, no matter what the population? And if you don't, what are you going to do? Because it's an obligation of schools that if you provide it to any student, you must provide it to every student and do it in a comparable way. So the issue of access is not only to the schools themselves. There was a time historically when we looked at whether black kids could go to schools that were for white skills. Yes, white kids. And we saw that in all kinds of forms. And so, and that was under de jure segregation or legal segregation. Now we're looking at those same phenomenon under the issue of de facto segregation, where it's just a matter of how people live and how they choose to congregate in their communities that create now segregated schooling. And the issue, once again, is that what does access and inclusion, who has access, and how are they included in schooling? One should want to see good schooling, no matter where a child happens to live, as opposed to what we see many times, too often, still yet, where you're in good schools if your parents have money and you live in a community that is enabled, and in that same district if you live on the other side of town, where poor folks are.
Growing so much.
Exactly, Christy. Then you don't have that same level of high-quality schooling.
It's interesting. I think probably access is one of, it's probably the thing people think of when they think of equitable schools.
Exactly.
I mean, because that's such a traditional issue. We've heard about it for so long, and yet it's still an issue both across a district but also within a school in terms of course offerings and access to higher level math and science, for example.
Right. And who gets scholarships and who become a part of what clubs and organizations that give other kinds of access and also marks you in a certain kind of way as being a desirable student or one worth investing time in and, and effort around and using materials to support, etc. Huge questions about levels of access, the quality of access, the direction of access and inclusion, and the outcomes as a result of it. All of those issues are hugely important. I personally, Christy, also believe that the next goal of equitable treatment works absolutely in tandem with this issue of access and inclusion. It does not make sense to include students who are culturally, racially different, their parents, etc., and then treat them like trash once they get inside the door. So this issue of treatment becomes hugely important, and there are a lot of dimensions to treatment. Do people feel safe? Do they feel respected? Do they feel honored and engaged? Are they sought out for their input? Or are they discarded? Are they shunted to the side? Are they disrespected? I am amazed that I still hear parents, for instance, in some of the communities that we work with across the south central part of the nation, who talk about the hostility that they perceive, not necessarily initially from the teachers and administrators, but people who work on the desks when they walk into the building and the way they're treated and talked down to. Well, all of that becomes a part of the reality that will make help people to make a decision about whether or not I want to be engaged in this place, I want to invest myself and my time in this place, or do I just want to endure this place until I can get to some other place? And many times that's out of school. I maintain that a part of the reason why kids are pushed out of school or choose to drop out of school is not a choice they make for themselves initially. It's a choice that others have made about them that they begin to respond to. And their response becomes, I can beat myself up. So why stay here and let other people do it for me? I think it's a huge issue. There are the persistent historic issues about treatment across racial lines and the resurgence of racial hostility that we're seeing in communities and schools. But now these issues of class and who has right to space and privilege and all of those things now become a part of the treatment issue as well, including in this day and age, technology and how you can use technology to mistreat that people through hostility, brutality, harassment, and those kinds
of bullying.
Bullying and so forth that now we're beginning to see. So the treatment issue is that is that next goal. The fourth goal is the opportunity to learn. I'm trying to move through these quickly, but this opportunity to learn is once you give access and you include populations, you've made a decision to treat them fairly and equitably, and you want to work with those ends and outcomes. A district has to ask itself, are we really giving this population of students a real opportunity to learn in terms of not only the content of the curriculum, but the depth and scope of it, the materials and extracurricular supports that are necessary to make this curriculum come to life so that it will equip this learner or these populations of learners with the knowledge and the skills and the competencies they need not only to move successfully through school, public school, but also to be able to competently move on into college or into the world of work. And so it is still a tragedy that as you go into poor schools or schools that are heavily minority, too many schools still yet don't give those populations of students a real opportunity to learn. And some of them atrociously just warehouse kids where they don't really teach them the information they need. They're not operating on reading on grade level. They're not getting the right level of courses in math and science or other core curricula that they may need. And so they're not getting a real opportunity to learn. They're doing some learning, but it's not the same kind of opportunity to learn that they really need to be able to compete with others in the school setting or across school settings or to compete for positions and seats in colleges and universities. We find out that our kids, if it's a high minority, high poverty school, and they graduate from a high school and go into college, that our kids find out too soon, some of our kids find out too soon, all the things they haven't learned in comparison to their counterparts who've gone to these other schools where they have really had enriched, powerful, dynamic learning. So even though they have both graduated, and even though they might both have graduated at the top of their classes, just the nature and the quality and the opportunity for learning one school versus or vis-a-vis another is entirely different.
Doesn't some of that come into expectations of what certain populations are capable of learning and how that can be discounting of the students?
Sure, and that starts back with equitable treatment. If I have conceptions that one population of students are not capable of doing that, it is going to affect how I treat them and what I engage them in. And how, even benevolently so, and I even have a problem with this, I don't want to tax their brains too much by causing them to think, or I don't want to challenge them with algebra. Let me give them some more simple math that they can do, when in fact algebra is one of those gatekeeping courses, you know. So yes, it really does affect how I even structure the opportunity to learn based upon what my conceptions of their capacity might be. Very important. Now, another issue that's extremely important is the next goal, which is the equitable distribution of resources. If we say that all students need high-quality learning and should be challenged to that, students should have access to a variety of courses and highly qualified teachers, and they need space for learning, and that space needs equipment and materials, then we begin to get into these distribution issues. You want to make sure that your highest qualified teaching staff is not just on that campus where you have middle class and upper level middle class and beyond kids, or in communities where you have those populations living. You want to make sure those highly experienced teachers are also found in those poor, high minority, high poverty schools as well, because it's that it's there where their talents are needed. So there needs to be an equitable distribution of resources in terms of teaching quality. But that's true for materials. It's true for the books that are used,
technology.
The technology, and all of the other supports that are needed, and the co-curricular supports like counseling and mentoring and coaching when that's needed, so that as the learners are navigating through the system, they have the right supports and the right materials and resources to make education happen for them. And then lastly, the issue of equitable accountability. Equitable in this case is shared accountability. It's not the same accountability, but it's shared. Everybody sees themselves as a key stakeholder, as needing to do something to make schools work. Parents have a voice in that and a right to be engaged in that. Teachers do, administrators do, board members, community people, because the quality of the educational public educational system of a community speaks to that community's health. And if you have a dysfunctional running school, then you probably have a community that is dysfunctional and in poor health. So those are those six goals. I laid them out relatively quickly, but just to give you a sense of what they're about.
And that would apply, let me just say this on the accountability, that all grades, even early childhood, has a role in the graduation of students.
Absolutely.
Of their students.
Absolutely.
So instead of kind of passing the blame on, it's shared, as you said.
It's shared. Mm-hmm. And it's taken on at all of those levels. For instance, even in early childhood, we knew about this foundation building. Setting that right mm-hmm. foundation really does place a learner right. on the right trajectory mm-hmm. toward graduation mm-hmm. because they learn to read.
Right.
They learn how to do good decision making. They begin to manage their lives in the construct of how schools might be organized, which sets them up for mm-hmm. success in kindergarten, mm-hmm. that springboards them
right.
into critical years, 1 through 3, mm-hmm. for laying the foundations for instance, learning how to read competently and powerfully in a way so that you can use reading for the rest of your schooling career
right.
to as a tool for learning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it just becomes hugely important.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't pass those successes or failures on, particularly the failures.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody
yes.
owns that.
Yes.
Must.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Must.
Mm-hmm. So how would a school leader use these goals? Or how have you worked with schools to use these goals to assess where they are?
Right. In addition to the rubric that we make available through the training and technical support that we provide, and based upon the groups that we are working with, so for instance, a school administrator, he or she has to think not only about the teachers, but about the administrative activity. They have to think about what policies are there, so that involves a different level of engagement.
Right.
That's the board, you know,
yeah.
making the right policy decisions mm-hmm. around these goals. And we work with school districts to help them construct mm-hmm. appropriate policy mm-hmm. to support the implementation of these goals. But parents, for instance, how do you make sure that parents understand that they not only have a right mm-hmm. to be involved and have their voice heard mm-hmm. in education of their children, but how do you make sure they have the right access?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what structures do I as an administrator need to change on my campus or in this district to make sure that access is not denied to certain parents?
Mm-hmm.
So I need to ask tough questions like, where might there be a problem in terms of providing access for parents?
Mm-hmm.
Making sure I get their voice.
Yeah.
Making sure I'm including them on the critical decisions mm-hmm. about how schooling is shaped.
Mm-hmm.
That same thing is true with treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Once these parents say, yes, I want to be engaged, I want to be involved, no, I don't have a college degree, I don't even speak English well, but I am interested, I want to be involved, how then do I as an administrator make sure that when that parent comes into school, they feel so valued,
mm-hmm.
they feel so right in this place, that they do want to invest themselves, their time, their energy, their thinking, their voice in the decisions that are made about the lives of their children in schools.
Mm-hmm.
That same thing is true around this opportunity to learn.
Mm-hmm.
See, I happen to think that education in this day and age has to be a public
mm-hmm.
undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's learning of all kinds going on. So students are doing one kind of learning, but I think that schools ought to be a place where parents do another kind
mm-hmm.
of learning
mm-hmm.
so that they become better equipped to support their children's success in schools. It's a place for teachers to learn.
That's right, absolutely.
And so building learning communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place for collegial support between and among administrators
mm-hmm.
so that as an administrator or of a campus or of a program, I'm making the right kinds of decisions to support all school student success.
Mm-hmm.
And so these goals become important in terms of helping them to raise the right questions. And I have a rubric that I use with school districts so that they, as they begin to ask these questions,
mm-hmm.
to pose these questions, then they begin to identify ways of providing the right responses.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be a change in policy, a different administrative practice, a different pedagogical undertaking on the part of teachers,
mm-hmm.
a different way of engaging parents. But at least they begin to ask the right questions and then to seek the right answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, the same thing is true with the resources. You can't tell parents, I want you to be involved, and that you don't provide resources to provide the information they need in a language they can understand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're not really providing
right.
an equitable opportunity if you're not willing to expend resources to make sure that they have not only access to the information, but access to an information in a way that they can understand and act upon it.
That's right. Be a part of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, really be a
right.
part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if
hey,
we're failing to do that, then we're also reneging on our responsibilities
mm-hmm.
and our accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So helping school folks to see that
mm-hmm.
as administrators, working with a board and around each one of these goals,
mm-hmm.
asking, do we have the right policies in place
mm-hmm.
to ensure that this notion of equitability can come to life
mm-hmm.
with regards to access, inclusion,
mm-hmm.
treatment, opportunity to learn,
mm-hmm.
the resources
mm-hmm.
to make that happen, and where all stakeholders share accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have the right policy decisions? Do we have the right funding initiatives
mm-hmm.
to allow these things to come to life in something more than just lip service, but in terms of the day-to-day business of this school district that we have been elected to run,
mm-hmm.
to operate?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes hugely important.
Do you typically start with like a task force with representation from different sectors, or get called in because of a particular problem, and you know that that one is going to need to get the initial focus?
It's both. So there have been communities where we have drawn together task force, mm-hmm. tri-racial, mm-hmm. tri-ethnic, or even multiracial, where we get Anglos, African-Americans, mm-hmm. Latinos together, and they begin through an assessment process mm-hmm. to answer one essential question, which is, does a school work well for all of our kids? Mm-hmm. And if it does, what is the proof or evidence? Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, where is the proof that mm-hmm. it does not, and how doesn't it? Mm-hmm. That kind of a task force would also not only do a deep analysis across a lot of areas right. and issues, but also would make a set of recommendations mm-hmm. for action, administrative action and board action, mm-hmm. That would become hugely important. But sometimes, Christy, the Office for Civil Rights, the monitoring arm and the oversight arm of the Department of Education, may find a district out of compliance, mm-hmm. and they may come in and call us in and ask us to provide support to a district around a certain issue. Mm-hmm. That is a violation of Title VI, the Civil Rights Act of Title VI, mm-hmm. or the Educational Amendments of 1972, or in some instances, the Rehabilitation Act of mm-hmm. 1973. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we do a little bit of both.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much. This has been a very good discussion. I did want to let you make one more point about how equity and excellence are so dependent on each other.
A quick comment is simply this, that you cannot speak about excellence if it's not working equitably for every child. Mm-hmm. Our public school systems have always worked for a population mm-hmm. of students, mm-hmm. but they haven't worked for the general population in the same kind of way. So you can't have excellence without equity. Mm-hmm. What you will have are schools that work for some kids, mm-hmm. and those same schools don't work for others. Mm-hmm. We are talking about a relationship in which, as one thinks about excellence, you know that it means mm-hmm. that it works for all learners, irrespective of their race, their color, their national origin, and their gender.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, and
my
thank
pleasure,
you, listeners.
Christy.
Please let us know what you've thought about today's topic and other topics that you'd like to hear about. We appreciate it, and have a good day.
Thank you for listening to IDRA Class Notes. For more information on IDRA and other Class Notes topics, go to www.idra.org. You can also send us your thoughts by email to podcast@idra.org or fill out the form on our podcast webpage at www.idra.org/podcasts.